Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm Detroit Economic Club welcome to Alan, Maurice, and Benkele. And Benkele, it's all yours. Take it away.
All right. Good afternoon. Thank you all for being here. We have quite a distinguished panel this afternoon. Alan Malak and Maurice Cox on poverty, quite an important subject. And you know, this is a subject that belongs right here in Detroit, because according to the 2016 US Census, this city, this American city, leads the nation among big cities on the question of economic inequality. The only city that comes second to Detroit is Cleveland, few hours away from here. So this conversation belongs right here. And I want to really give credit to Steve for bringing this conversation before the Economic Club and its members. Alan, let me begin with you. I think the introduction says it all. Poverty in America, in Detroit. How do we begin to combat poverty in a way where we begin to see some reductions?
That is difficult. But I think what we've been seeing in the United States for the last few decades is an increasing inequality. More poor, more wealthy, fewer people in the middle. And what's happening in the cities parallels that. So we have this amazing revival taking place in cities like Detroit, Cleveland, Chicago, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia. And yet, the poverty in these cities and the neighborhood decline is still great, and in many cases, it's growing at the same time as more affluent people are moving into parts of the cities, other parts are becoming poorer. So I think it comes down, ultimately, what we need to do, and the fact that these cities are growing means that there is an opportunity here. What we need to do is focus on systematically lifting people out of poverty. And what that involves is first helping people get decent jobs. Interestingly, thank you. We have a lot of jobs in the cities, and institutions like Detroit Medical Center, Henry Ford, the company, are growing more jobs. And yet, the vast majority of those jobs are not held by people who live in the city, are not held by people who have come out of poverty. And so I think the first piece is, how do we create a system which both increases the opportunities for jobs on the part of all of those companies and institutions and organizations that exist in the city, and at the same time prepares people? And this isn't simply a matter of specific job skills, but it's a much more complicated matter than that. Prepares people to be able to get and hold those jobs. And the second piece is, what kind of educational opportunities are we offering the kids of the low-income families who live in Detroit? I think that, are we offering, for a kid who's growing up in one of the distressed neighborhoods on the west side or the east side, do they have educational opportunities that will enable that kid to move out of poverty and find real opportunity?
Right.
Or are they getting the kind of education that simply makes it a revolving door? And I think those are two fundamental issues. They're both issues that can be dealt with, but they're both incredibly difficult and have a lot of moving parts.
So one more question, and I'll go to Maurice. When you look at where Detroit is, and you really render Detroit, Pittsburgh, and other cities in your book in terms of where they are on the economic index, when you look at Detroit here, where it is, what concerns you most?
I think Detroit is in a fascinating place, because if you look, say, take the last two decades, Detroit was basically on a steady downward trajectory from the end of the 20th century to, I don't know exactly what point it hit bottom. But I don't think many cities in the United States have hit bottom to the extent that Detroit has. And I hope I'm not hurting anybody's feelings. And during that period, Detroit lost more than half of its middle class population and became poor, as well as a quarter of its population, period. And so what's fascinating, I think Detroit is starting to move in the opposite direction. You're seeing real change in this city in terms of physical change. You're seeing change in terms of the political climate, but it's still got a long, long way to go.
All right, Maurice Cox, we are in the belly of the beast here. From Alan's analysis, and it's an analysis that I agree with, is that it looks as if, when you look at where this current economic trajectory is headed, that you're taking one step forward, two steps backwards. Can you agree or you disagree?
I don't agree with the steps backwards. I think that the city is clearly at a pivot point now, and the economic trends are in our favor, and they are not by chance. They're a result of policy. I actually would summarize what you were describing as, you know, jobs, schools, and neighborhoods, and they all have to move forward together. But on the jobs front, you know, there are more Detroiters working today than any time in a decade, 230,000. The poverty rate is trending down from like 39% to now 35%. That translates directly into increased household incomes that are rising. And then, of course, the challenge in Detroit is, well, as soon as you get a job, you know, the middle class moves out to the suburbs. Well, guess what? They are staying, and they're seeing enough signs of change in their neighborhoods to believe that they are reviving. And so I think we start from a position of valuing the people that we have and building this recovery for them. And it, of course, will attract additional populations that we also need to grow this city.
So let me ask you then, because the numbers here, look at the census, 39 to 35, it still leads the nation. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at Future City Report, the Urban Institute Report. I can go on a litany of reports that basically says the entire economic buoyancy is confined within Midtown and Downtown. The question, though, is when you look at that, what has been done structurally and systematically to ensure that the next report that comes out would clearly indicate that, in fact, there is a move with all deliberate speed to reduce these numbers?
Yeah, no, I, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about where does a city recovery start? And inherently, it starts at the heart of a city, in its downtown. It has the job base, it has extraordinary sense of place, and I would include Midtown, which, you know, has EDS, it has MEDS, it has the cultural institutions. That clearly is where the recovery starts, and then it immediately has begun to spill over into adjacent to the downtown neighborhoods, and we're starting to see those areas grow. I think Detroit has decided to use some of those strategies that have worked in the downtown and midtown and leapfrog over to the neighborhoods where the vast majority of Detroiters live. So I can now list 10 neighborhood geographies where effectively 250,000 Detroiters live, where we now have a framework for how they too will grow, albeit at a much slower rate. But it's around this issue of making neighborhoods worth staying in, which means housing rehab, which means demolition, which means reimagining the purpose of vacant properties, creating neighborhood shopping districts that you can walk to with a grocery store, and schools that are in those same areas. So I believe, really, for the first time, Detroit has a strategy to retain those who are in our neighborhoods and to grow them.
One more question, I'll go to Alan here. When you look at the federal neighborhood, no matter where you stand on the island, that are there lessons to be learned with that in terms of Maurice, the federal neighborhood?
Sure, and for those of you who don't know, we started a pilot to explore what it would be like to work in neighborhoods that are not adjacent to downtown, but literally are miles away, 6 miles away from downtown, and look at those neighborhoods on their own terms with the strengths that they have. So single family housing, proximity to flagship institutions like UD Mercy, Mary Grove College. And the other thing is having a critical mass of property that is owned by the land bank that could be rehabbed, and vacant properties that might be repurposed. And so the Fitzgerald Project is a pretty audacious experiment that hasn't been tried in any place in America yet, where we are going in over a period of years and renovating 100 homes and planting 200 gardens. So it's a very pragmatic strategy.
So what are there lessons to be learned in terms of the report that came out?
That it's difficult, so that this work is hard.
Some serious hiccups, right. Some serious hiccups, though. Right.
Absolutely. Right. So tying the lot next door and planting a beautiful flowering meadow is something that a housing rehab developer had never tried before. And so they too are learning how to make that land a part of the recovery strategy. So I think it's really important for us to understand that Detroit is at the forefront of experimentation and exploration in neighborhood revitalization. These are pilots. We're going to learn as we go along, and we're going to shift courses. And I can now point to 7 such areas that have uniquely tailored strategies that work with the residents who are there and the assets in those particular neighborhoods. And guess what? We are going to learn something from each one of them and bring those lessons to the next crop of neighborhoods that have similar kinds of assets.
Alan, is that the right course of action? Is that the right right action?
I think it's part of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't, you know, the physical condition of neighborhoods is one part of the piece. I think it does 2 things. One is to try to both retain and bring back the middle class. One thing, Detroit lost from 2000 to roughly 2015. From 2000 to 2015, roughly, Detroit lost over 50% of its black middle-class families. Now, bringing back that population is going to depend on having neighborhoods where people can feel they're safe, they like the quality of life that neighborhood offers, it provides decent education opportunities, the whole piece. So that's really important. Another thing that's important is that for people who are here, and this is true whether they're middle class, working class, poor, whatever, having a decent quality of life in your neighborhood is fundamental. People should be able to live in a neighborhood. Not everybody's going to live in Grosse Pointe, but people should be able to have a neighborhood where there is decent housing quality, decent environmental quality, decent safety, and decent schools. I think that should be seen as an absolutely fundamental premise of how the city operates. But then at the same time, it has to be tied in to the questions of jobs and schools. And I think the school issue is a huge one in this city, and not every family can do what a friend of mine referred to as the workaround, which is if you live in an area like Grandmont, Rosedale, close, and you work in, say, Bloomfield Hills or Farmington, and you put your kid in a school district outside the city. That's not an option for most people. And I think at this point, That's a fundamental issue that really has to be thought through. And I'm not quite sure, and I'm sure Maurice has been thinking about this, is how to integrate the physical neighborhood strategies that fall under his territory with rebuilding the type of educational and other strategies that basically are in the hands of others, but should be coordinated.
And I'd like to tag on to that, because I do think that it's jobs, you know, schools, and neighborhoods, and they have to be looked at holistically. So by the city focusing for the first time on areas where we want to genuinely retain residents and grow those areas, you can now begin to have a conversation with the school's school district about what's the school piece. So the Fitzgerald neighborhood, which is the kind of working class component of a larger geography that has a big, that still has a very strong middle class. Well, it's not by chance that the Kresge Foundation, just next door to the Fitzgerald neighborhood, is exploring a one-of-a-kind educational model with the reimagining of Marygrove College that will go from 0 to 20. So zero pre-K, the full assortment of K to 12, and then college, all on one campus. They're doing that because they are seeing an area that can be stabilized and can continue to grow. So with the educational piece, you have to have really innovative new models that will retain families. So I would argue that the first out is going to be the 0 to 4. So if family moves into the Fitzgerald neighborhood, we got 4 years where they're gonna go to a flagship early childhood learning center. By the time they get their kid in elementary, it buys us some time to see how that experiment is going. And I think for every one of these strategic neighborhoods where we're identifying, you need a strategic model for education as well.
Maurice, let me ask you, the governing philosophy of this administration on poverty. I ask it because it is no accident that Allen's book is titled The Divided City. But if you talk to a lot of people here in the city who have been observing this city for a long time, including myself, there is an accepted premise that, in fact, there is a divided city. And I know there are folks who don't see it that way, but I want to know the governing philosophy of this administration when it comes to poverty. And do you accept that, in fact, you know, in as much as you are in the driver's seat in this recovery, it is two Detroits?
I honestly
don't accept that premise?
I don't. I think we're building one city, and you can tell by our policy with around housing. We are, with the help of the council, requiring 20% affordable housing in every housing development which receives any kind of public subsidy. That's a clear signal that we're not going to segregate people by income. We are going to encourage the integration of all. And so when we say, yeah, we're building one city, and it's for all of us, look at the policies and see how that gets reflected. In the area which I have some, you know, control over.
Jurisdiction.
It is, you know, these neighborhoods, it's 100 homes in this one particular area, but they're not simply market rate housing. There are varying scales of affordability so that it is accessible to all folks. And I think you'll find that same thing in our strategy for jobs and workforce development, the same attitude about how we're approaching the schools.
On affordable housing, quickly, and I'll go back to Alan here. The Detroit News reported about a month and a half ago that, in fact, in the next 2-3 years, that we may see a decline in affordable housing. And I read the administration's response, which did not, in my view, again, my opinion here, did not really fully explain in terms of what's the contingency plan or the intervention, if you will, here to stem what the Detroit News said, a decline in affordable housing.
Yeah, well, I can tell you what the strategy is for my colleagues, Don Rencher, in housing and redevelopment. The city has made a commitment to preserve 10,000 units of federally regulated housing and to raise $250 million fund to assure that that happens. So when we go into a neighborhood, the first thing we look at is the affordable housing and when it's going to expire and how we can get in there and renew those in perpetuity, plus a commitment to 2,000 new units of affordable housing. So every development that gets built, we're inserting affordability into the conversation. I don't know many cities in America that have made this kind of commitment to preserve the affordable housing that we have, as well as encouraging that every market rate development project has housing affordability integrated into it.
Alan?
There are a couple that are on a similar track. I would point to Baltimore and Pittsburgh as two that are trying to move in the same direction in terms of both, because this is a huge problem all over the country. When affordable housing developments have been built over the last 20, 30, 40 years, they're always built with a limited period during which they have to stay affordable housing, and then they are at the mercy of the market unless a city steps in. So it's a huge issue. But there's another issue, which I think, in fact, I spoke a few weeks ago at the Affordable Housing Conference, I made this point. Detroit is a fascinating situation. On the one hand, housing costs in Detroit, both rents and sales prices, are the lowest of any major city in the United States. At the same time, tens of thousands of Detroiters are severely cost burdened and can't find housing that's affordable to them. And the crux of the problem is that thousands of Detroiters are literally too poor to be able to afford, quote, affordable housing, unquote, which is targeted to people who may earn, say, $25,000 or $30,000 or $35,000 or $40,000 a year, which certainly is not wealthy by any means. So Detroit really has to also be looking at, I think, much more significantly, much more systematically, how do we maintain a decent quality and affordability within the private rental stock? Because most low-income Detroiters don't live in affordable housing projects and don't have housing vouchers. They live in houses and apartment buildings, usually owned by mom and pop landlords, many of whom have no idea what they're doing, and are struggling to find decent housing that they can even come close to affording. So this is a huge problem which affects tens of thousands of Detroiters.
So let me ask this, and Maurice, you can chime in here as well. I'm listening to you, Alan, talk. The market forces, there are other forces here that are linked to this recovery, and I don't think it's fair to talk about poverty absent of these forces. The corporate community, corporate Detroit, and the foundations. Now, as someone who has observed this ebb and flow of this recovery over the last two decades, you know, I can go back to a decade when millions of dollars have been pumped in to the city, quote unquote, to help and sustain and so forth. But yet, you know, when a census report comes up, another report comes back, it's like a gut punch. Like, what are we doing differently? What would you recommend, Alan, for foundations and corporations to bear in mind, though, if especially given that they're stakeholders in this recovery?
Okay. I think there are two or three key things, and it goes back to where can corporations, where can foundations, but I mean, clearly, no foundation is in a position of putting in the literally hundreds of billions of dollars that it might take to transform the physical environment of this city. As far as I know, only Dan Gilbert is in a position to do that. but what they can, I think where their role is critical is less in the physical environment of the neighborhoods, and more in the issues of jobs and education. And I think the program that Maurice referred to at Marygrove, where Kresge is basically taking the lead in creating a innovative educational opportunity, is I think a good example of what can be done. I think corporations need to focus on the job opportunities that they represent and the investment opportunities in local business that they represent. And when I say corporations, that includes the Medical Center, Henry Ford, Wayne State, all of the major institutions, because they're among the biggest players in this city. The other issue is figuring out how to create what I'd call a seamless workforce development system, where somebody in this city who needs and wants a job can not only get the job training, but also get the support that he or she needs to deal with issues of trauma and emotional stress, issues of legal disabilities, issues of basic education, and have that system tied to the job opportunities that exist within the society, within the local economy. Because every year, tens of thousands of jobs open up in Detroit. The great majority of those jobs do not require a college degree. And I think it's critically important that once the workforce system is developed and a pipeline of people who have the skills and the readiness to take those jobs exist, that corporate and institutional Detroit be ready to hire those people.
And all I can say with regard to this coordinated kind of one-stop shop for those who are trying to connect to employment opportunities, Detroit at Work, Detroit at Work, Detroit at Work. For those of you who have never gone on that site, it's an amazing site where you can now find hundreds of jobs that are real jobs that are available, and the kind of wraparound services that you're talking about to get people ready to take those jobs. But I'd like to address the question about, you know, where are the corporations? If their focus has been downtown or their headquarters are downtown, how do you bring them into the conversation about neighborhoods? And the administration under this new fund called the Strategic Neighborhood Fund that will fund parks and affordable housing and greenways and multifamily housing, the kinds of things that we think are going to make these neighborhoods grow. The foundations were the first there. So we had foundations like Kresge make a pledge of $15 million. There's a desire to raise about $50 million that would go to these targeted investments. And then the corporations right. came forward just a while ago, some of you may have heard it, and pledged $5 million each to this Strategic Neighborhood Fund. And these are not names that we have historically seen associated with neighborhood revitalization. They're like American Axle, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Chemical Bank, Fifth Third Bank, Flagstar Bank, and it goes on. And so I would think that there is a new model emerging where it's not just public and not just philanthropy, but the corporations are coming in and putting real dollars.
So let me preface just a few seconds why I asked the question. Mm-hmm. So, as an observer, I remember several years ago I was in a room with Carol Goss, who was the head of the Skillman Foundation, and with Dave Egner, he was head in Hudson Webber then before he became CEO of Ralph Wilson. The three of us were in Carol Goss's office debating mm-hmm. about what intentional equity is, mm-hmm. and I said to Dave that it's one thing to give money. But it's another thing to follow that money to make sure that, in fact, you are achieving the Absolutely. Desired result or the purpose for which you've written that check.
Absolutely.
Because I can go back to a time where I can tell you what Skillman has written, foundations have written these checks, and the census yep. reports say we're still yep. the largest in the nation on poverty.
Yeah.
So the question is, what are we doing to move the needle?
Yeah. Well, in fact, I mean, if you look at the neighborhood frameworks that we're talking about, you will see half a dozen to a dozen tangible projects. It's a park here, it's this half a mile of reimagined streetscape, it's this multifamily mixed-use building. They are real projects that people can say 18 months, 24 months, 36 months later, did it happen or did it not? It's not a black hole where money goes and you don't know to what end. We can now articulate very, very precisely what sites are going to be transformed, what streets are going to be transformed, what parks are going to be transformed. It's investment in the public realm. And I think that's the key. That's where you have the largest benefit to the most people, places where folks can see their dollars invested. They can see the recovery in real time. And that hasn't always been the way the resources were spent.
Alan?
I think that's part of it. The other part, yeah. The other part, I think the foundations and the corporations and the city really have to focus on what are the outcomes and look systematically. I think one thing, and Maurice pointed out earlier, that in the last couple of years, there's been a very powerful turnaround in some of the most important indicators of Detroit's sort of social health, such as the poverty rate, such as the percentage of middle-class families staying in the city. I think that's what we really have to monitor, and that's what I hope that corporations and foundations will focus their energy on. How can I, foundation such and such, support activities in Detroit that are going to move the needle in terms of whether it's educational outcomes for low-income kids, whether it's more jobs for low-income city residents and better jobs, whether it's things like job stability. I think there are a whole series of things which the city has to look at. Where are we going in this process of becoming a one Detroit? And track very closely, and that I think both corporations and foundations should be saying, how can we invest in ways that strategically move those needles? Not things that look good or feel good for this week or this month, but have significant sustained change.
All right, Maurice, do you want to preview the mayor's State of the City address?
I will tell you, it's going to focus on the people who are actually producing this change. They are the thousands of people who show up at these planning exercises to prioritize what they want to see in their neighborhood. And they are driving, the revitalization. It's an amazing thing to see. We'll be in a meeting this Saturday where Jefferson Chalmers residents will be presented with their priorities for neighborhood change. And then the week after that, on the 21st, we'll be in Banglatown East Davidson talking about the set of recommendations that that community would like to see, the investments. So finally, residents are driving the revitalization, and the mayor would like to focus on them because they're the heroes this time.
All right, I'll hand it over to Steve Gregorian for questions from the audience.
Thank you, and how about a round of applause for a fascinating conversation? Frankly, I invite you to jump in on some of these too, because I know you're passionate about some of these. So we asked our audience, I've got a lot of questions. I'm gonna start with one for Alan, please. In our desire to reduce poverty and inequality, is there a danger we choke off the revival of nascent America's major cities?
I think it's a very small one, not a major risk. Because first, I think certainly no city can afford to simply say, our revival is a done deal, now we can focus on alleviating poverty and lifting up people. They have to simultaneously keep working at the revival. One thing which I'll just sort of remind everybody, Detroit's revival coincides with a period of sustained economic growth in the United States, an extended period. That isn't going to last forever. Is it going to end next year, 2 years from now, 3 years, 5 years? Nobody knows. But it is going to end. And Detroit has to continue to build a revival that can sustain itself despite regional, national, and global economic shocks. However, I believe that if the city focuses just on that, and this is true not just Detroit, but any city, and does not focus on bridging the gap between the haves and the have-nots, the wealthy and the poor, and so forth, ultimately, that will start to choke off the revival. Because I don't think we see a city which is essentially a city of a small number of wealthy people and prosperous institutions, essentially closing themselves off with a wall against the great mass of the rest of the city. That's not the city we want, but that's a city that many American cities seem to be moving towards if they don't watch out. So I think ultimately, focusing on poverty actually can strengthen the revival, but only if the city is able, as they say, to walk and chew gum at the same time and keep both tracks moving.
Thank you. Maurice, we've heard the adjective welcoming when we're talking about neighborhoods. So in your opinion, describe a welcoming neighborhood. What does that look like to you, and how realistic is that we're driving towards a welcoming neighborhood?
I found Detroiters in general to be very welcoming a city planner. A lot of the neighborhoods we work in have never seen a city planner before, and I'm always amazed at the incredible resiliency and positive attitude that people bring to these conversations. Ultimately, what I'm hoping is that we can test this idea of whether we can build one city where everyone feels welcome, that we're not making these arbitrary divides, that our neighborhoods will attract, retain working class families, that there's a place if you are trying to emerge out of poverty, and these same neighborhoods welcome new families with children. And we pack them with the kinds of amenities that we know retain families. So we had a big inauguration of the Fitzgerald Park. It's a 2.5 acre park in a part of the neighborhood that's never had a gathering space. Well, 200 people came out, all walks of life, all races, to celebrate that achievement over a really fine meal. And it had the kind of social mixing that I think we all would be proud of. And I think it can be done if you create those public places and they're of quality and they feel safe and welcoming, I think people will come.
So on that note, though, where do you place gentrification in the context of this conversation, Alan? Do you see what is happening as a textbook case of gentrification? Maurice, is that the way you say it, Alan?
No. I think the word gentrification has so many different meanings and is used in so many different ways. And it's interesting, just a friend of mine a couple years ago taught a graduate seminar out in Washington University, and he told me this story. There was a young black graduate student in his class who kept pushing back when they were talking about gentrification and neighborhood change and stuff. And finally, this student lost patience with him and said, "Professor, you just don't get it. When you talk about gentrification, you're talking about house prices and household incomes and so forth. When we talk about gentrification, it's about powerlessness." And I think we've got to realize when people talk about gentrification, they talk about a lot of different things. Because in Detroit today, if you're looking at neighborhoods where house prices are rising beyond the reach of, say, a working class family, and large numbers of people are coming in and conceivably pushing out other people, there are very, very few neighborhoods that fit that description.
Yeah,
When you talk about neighborhoods that are going in the opposite direction, where the middle class has left and people are getting poorer and household housing values have declined, even though things are starting to turn around, there's still an awful lot more of those neighborhoods than there are neighborhoods that can be considered gentrifying. So I think Detroit, obviously, any city has to be concerned about displacement, about pushing people out, about loss of affordability. And these are issues that are citywide issues. But I think for Detroit to even begin to think that it should discourage people from moving into the city because of fears that they will somehow gentrify and push people out, I think is basically a very counterproductive notion. Detroit once had 2 million people. Right. Now it has slightly under, I think, 700,000. Yes. There's room for lots of people in this
yes,
city.
I agree. And I would add that, you know, when we hold a community meeting, you know, the folks who are there are often people who remember the neighborhood when they had neighbors. They had many, the blocks were full, and they want them back. They want their neighbors back. And so we look first at rehabbing the incredible housing stock that we have and making sure that there's a range of affordability so that you can grab all incomes and all family types. So I too believe we've got 200 neighborhoods, self-identified neighborhoods in Detroit, and they all have a very, very unique soul. The ones that are growing, I can count on one hand. So we have so many neighborhoods that still have the potential to be stabilized and be revitalized and welcome new families in them. I'm certainly not one of those who think that, you know, so many of our neighborhoods are gentrifying, we have to, you know, warning. No. Not enough of our neighborhoods are being stabilized and revitalized. We're going in the right direction. We are way off from having to this primary concern that we don't have enough space in our city for tens of thousands of more residents.
Maurice, let me stick with you. How are you incorporating the residents' wishes in your planning?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I was directed when I took this job was, you know, the mayor said, I want a champion of neighborhoods. You know, he said, you know, a lot of planning directors are make their name on fancy downtown development. I want a champion of neighborhoods. So I knew from the very first day where my assignment would be. And we've started to actually identify that neighborhood geography that we think we can revitalize first. And then we'll continue to go through the city as we learn lessons. He wanted it done with residents. And so in our meetings, neighbors will prioritize the things they want to see done first in this notion of investment in the public realm. Is it on the commercial neighborhood street that you would like to find the kinds of shops and amenities, or is it in, you know, parks? And if the neighborhood says, I want you to focus on the commercial corridor, that's where we focus. And if they say, you know, it's our park system and having quality park, we'll start there. So I actually believe in the democratic process that you put very pragmatic, real strategies in front of people and you ask them to make informed choices given the information that they have, and knowing that there is an investment line for every one of those improvements. So we don't show residents a single thing that's a pie in the sky delivery. Every one of them has a line item, an investment strategy that can be executed in a time where they can actually see their neighborhoods being revived.
In hindsight, when you look back though, are there any lessons learned in the ACLU lawsuit with the city of Detroit to keep poor Detroiters in their homes moving forward?
Well, as I said, I mean, I think the lesson learned is every single resident is valued. We need them all. We have to stem the flight from this city. So that means poor people, we want you to stay and we want to see your incomes rise and connect you to jobs. Middle class, we want to see you come back. And the black middle class can be constructed again. So I think, yes, I mean, in the end, every citizen has a value and is a part of the needed comeback, and no one should be excluded from that.
I'm going to give the last question to Alan and help plug your book, which again will be for sale at the end of this. But tremendous book. It is a must read if you're interested in pursuing this subject a little bit more. Were there any surprises as you did your research in producing this book?
Well, I think certainly my thinking shifted as I wrote it and as I researched it. And one thing, most of my background has been in city planning and housing and development in neighborhoods. And that's obviously a subject very dear to my heart. But what I learned is the more I read, the more I talked to people, the more I went places, and how central the schools and the jobs issues were. And the thing that was really, really opened my eyes, I think, is that we often tend to think, I think when we're not thinking seriously, that, you know, it's kind of a hopeless cause. And it really isn't. What I found programs in different cities, places where you had programs that were working with the toughest people to work with, young male ex-offenders coming back from prison, and getting them into decent jobs that they then held those jobs. I saw schools that are taking kids from the toughest neighborhoods in their cities and not only helping them get into college, but seeing that these kids graduated from college. Now, obviously, this isn't the norm, or this country would be wildly different. But the fact is, I found that there are people all over this country, a program in Minneapolis, a program in Boston, a program in Atlanta, that are making an enormous difference in terms of transforming lives of people whom large parts of this society has, frankly, all but written off. And if it can be done on a small scale here and there, I see no reason, assuming we care enough and are willing to put our energy and our resources there, that it can't be done on a scale large enough to transform not only a city like Detroit, but our country.
Thank you, Alan. All right, I've got 1 minute left. We're gonna do a really quick lightning round. All right, are you ready? Bankole, you can jump in here too. We're gonna start with Alan. Something on your bucket list?
Something. I would like to write and publish a novel.
Maurice.
My bucket list. I actually would like to travel every country on the globe.
Bankole.
You keep adding countries, you know.
Am I part of it too?
Of course.
Well, I'm gonna continue to write.
All right, terrific. A person other than a family member you'd like to have lunch with, Alan.
I was thinking about that. I think Frederick Douglass.
Very good. Maurice.
He's a man who had an incredible personal story, had an incredible breadth of understanding and knowledge, and viewed the world not as a zero-sum, us-them world, but as an inclusive world where people could live together.
Yeah, I think I'll try, well, I mean, again, it's a dead one, but Martin Luther King. I would be fascinated to see what he would think of the journey that we've taken since the Civil Rights Movement.
Pope Francis, I'm a big fan of the Pope and the fact that he has made his, you know, his purpose about poverty, inequality. So that would be something that I would cherish at lunch with the Pontiff.
Alan, describe Detroit in one word.
Gutsy.
Resilient.
Crisis.
All right, and final one. You can take a little bit more time with us. Alan, advice to your 25-year-old self.
Don't panic, and don't think because you haven't gotten there yet, you can't still. You can keep growing. I mean, I'm in my mid-70s now, And I think I'm still growing. So you can keep growing all your life.
There are, I guess, a couple. One, I think I would ask that you cross as many disciplinary boundaries as you can in your life, and you meet incredibly different people and different ways of thinking. And then knowing that it takes a bit of courage, I would say, leap, and the net will appear. Don't worry about it. Leap, and the net will appear.
Last word to Bankerling.
Well, it's never too late to start anything. Be bold and courageous, because someday you will be vindicated.
Terrific. Ladies and gentlemen, a round of applause for our terrific panel. Alan Malik, thanks for joining us from New Jersey. Maurice Cox, keep doing the great work you're doing. Bankole, same to you. Continue doing the great work you're doing at the Detroit News and the Pulse Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, reminder, right outside if you want to purchase the book, and Alan will join you in just a couple minutes to sign that. And thank you for coming. This meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.